Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our ever-expanding exploration of the cultures of consciousness. One thing about spending a lot of my time in Houston, Texas these days is it really makes me appreciate the place that I'm from San Francisco. Now, San Francisco is kind of a silly place. In California, one often comes across arguments about whether San Francisco or Los Angeles is really, you know, the cool place to be or not. And a lot of Angelenos think San Franciscans are kind of, snooty and a little pretentious and kind of precious. And a lot of San Franciscans think Los Angeles folks are, conniving and narcissistic and materialistic and empty. But I think they're both right and wrong, and that we should really celebrate the bipolarness of California. But at the moment, I'm really thinking about San Francisco, which is the place, of course, that I think more than even one conservative has said that if they bomb America, they can at least just take out San Francisco and do the rest of the country a favor. And I love that kind of rhetoric. It makes me proud. I'm proud of the excessive, goofy, hedonistic idealism of my city. And being something of a California historian, I also appreciate where it comes from. And this is one real simple fact about California is that unlike every other major city in the nation, San Francisco was never marked by Puritanism. It was never a Puritan town. Other big cities in the West Coast, Los Angeles is a great example, even though it started out all wild and woolly, had a huge influx of conservative Midwesterners that really helped make the city and certainly make the LAPD, for example. But San Francisco never had a Protestant Puritanical culture, and it's been a wild and woolly place continuously since it was created. There are accounts of the Barbary Coast in the late 19th century, the sort of, the wild zone of taverns and brothels and God knows what else. And they read not unlike descriptions of Burning Man. And indeed, there's sort of a continuity, a sort of culture of costumed, excessive, hedonic, political, if you make it be that way, and utopian, if you don't, kind of culture in my fair city. And so one of the things I miss about San Francisco are the parties and the costumes, both of which are kind of a form of art there that I have not really seen matched exactly the same way anywhere else. And before I introduce our guest, who sort of exists at the nexus of the today's creative community building hedonic party madness in San Francisco, I want to bring on Maja Dao, who may have some opinions about this because she is an Angeleno. So what do you think, Maja? What do you think about the San Francisco Los Angeles rivalry?
Well, I think it's pretty entertaining just because I'm an Angeleno, but I mean, I moved here, so it's not like I'm from here. And I'm actually from the Northwest and, like, you know, went to the Evergreen State College, which is notoriously hippie school where they'd have orgies and all that kind of thing. So, and then I've also been to San Francisco a lot and kind of hung out there, and my cousins live there and stuff like that. So, I mean, the way I see it is that Los Angeles is like, they're way more snobby in their kind of perception, and they have such a, like, totally specific version of what sexuality is that's, like, mass media style. And to me, the San Francisco one is more like kind of come-as-you-are type of thing. I think where Los Angeles tries to manufacture sexuality, San Francisco is more like a reflection of the reality of the sexual nature of people.
I think that's extremely perceptive. It makes me think of a movie that I'm sure our guest Polly Superstar will have a comment about, but I just want to mention it while I'm thinking of it, is The Cockettes, which is a wonderful, wonderful documentary about a performance troupe in the 60s, which even though I had read a fair amount about the counterculture in San Francisco, I had never heard more than a mention of, really a phenomenal troupe. And part of what made them so amazing is that they took the art of like cheap costuming to an extraordinary degree, and it really reminds me, and it's not often talked about, just how important costume is to San Francisco, to its erotic life, to its cultural life, to its relationship to Halloween, to all sorts of things. It's really, there's no other place on the planet I've been where costume's so important. But the other thing that was interesting about the Cockettes is their gender play, and there was some very powerful gay members of the troupe. There were heterosexuals, there were who knows what, and the part of their vibe was this kind of crazy, confusing, glorious mess in a way that worked perfectly well in San Francisco, if not other places that they played, which is one of the interesting things about the movie. So check it out. But enough chatter from me. I want to bring on Polly Superstar. Hi, Polly.
How's it going?
Good, good. You sound okay. Are you warm and cozy there?
I am. Yeah. Thank you.
Wonderful. I'm gonna read Polly's bio because I asked her to write me something, and it was so like crisply put together. I usually don't read the bios, but I like this one. Polly Superstar lives in San Francisco, producing events, cultivating creative community, and socially innovating with her partner Baron Scott Levkoff, who we'll have on the show one of these days. Their collaborations have birthed many projects, including a sex-positive community space called Mission Control, an award-winning costume cabaret event, which is spread across the world, called Kinky Salon, a social network for the open-minded, openly, and more than a few rounds of mini-golf. That's right, Peep Show mini-golf. One of the many extraordinary things that one may stumble across, as I did the first time I saw Peep Show mini-golf, I sort of out of nowhere, there it is, people playing mini-golf in a Peep Show context. So, Polly, thanks a lot for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
And I want to start out, you know, usually I like talking to people about how they got where they were, and I know that's a story for all of us, but if you could just tell us, I mean, obviously from your voice, you're not from San Francisco, so I'd love to know a little bit about your trajectory and how you found yourself kind of working at this interesting nexus of community building and sex-positive culture.
Okay, well, obviously, I'm not from around here. I'm from London, and my mother was actually a very well-known sex therapist in the 1970s. A lot of the work that she did really paved the way for the way that people talk about sexuality now in therapy. And she has programs that she put in place that are still in place today, and is a very respected sex therapist. You know, one of the very first people to even call themselves a sex therapist, specifically, as opposed to a relationship therapist. And so I was raised in a very unusual household where there was a very open attitude towards sexuality. So I was told very early what sex is about and how it happened and kind of all the details, to be honest with you, probably more than a young child should know. but done with such an air of like innocence and positivity that I never really had any bad feelings towards sexuality. Like most people in their lives at some point from their parents get some sort of shame instilled in them, whether it's, you know, don't touch there, that's dirty, don't show yourself like that. Like, whereas I was constantly taking my clothes off and running around, and like I was never told that that was bad. I was never told that my nakedness was bad or that my sexuality was bad. And so I think I had a really unique perspective growing up. And when I started to realize when I got older that that people actually had shame around this, and this was quite a big deal for our culture, I was kind of shocked when I reached my teen years and kind of looked around me and went, wow, everyone's really kind of screwed up over this. This is a really intense thing. And yet I would seem to be completely free of these kind of these cultural issues that most people have. And so I, from a very early age,
started to get interested in kind of alternative sexuality and sexual expression, but almost from the point of innocence. Like I say, there wasn't any kind of weird, pervy need around it. It was more just kind of like an exploration for me. And I started going to fetish clubs in London, just at the birth of the fetish scene in the early 90s in London. And the experience that I had there was so different from anything that I could experience from going to like a bar or a normal club, because women were really highly respected. And there was this level of appreciation and etiquette also around interacting that made me feel really safe. And so I was really intrigued by what it was about this experience in the fetish scene that created such a safe space. And so then when I moved to America, which was in 1999, and I was completely blown away by the culture here in San Francisco, by the sex-positive culture here, and by, you know, the whole Burning Man thing and the art subculture and creative community, and met my partner, Scott Levkoff, and then we kind of created this this event together called Kinky Salon. And that was just kind of our coming together. It wasn't really planned or thought about, or there wasn't too much kind of you know, theorizing around it. We were just kind of doing what was fun for us. And then as the years went on, this kind of pattern emerged of, you know, a kind of a menu of things that you do to create this safe space. A lot of it was influenced from my early fetish scene experience, and then also from this kind of Burning Man vibe, and those things kind of brought together to create this event, which has become our most kind of well-known event. And we've taken that formula and given it away to event producers across the world, so we now have people replicating that formula in other countries around the world and creating kinky salons.
Well, that's great, but I want to talk a little bit about what is that difference, because I think people, you know, whether or not they've, you know, gone to fetish clubs or sex clubs or just sort of read about it, you know, that often there is this kind of a sort of dark, pervy edge to the thing, like it's something naughty and kind of intense and a little bit scary or whatever, and that's often like an association that people have with it, and yet your experience and the kind of situation you're creating is much more, well, fun, and is a sort of kind of simple way to put it, but what accounts for that? Like, what accounted for that even in the fetish scene that you talked about? I was really interested with your description of the kind of respect you felt women had, and a kind of an etiquette or a sense of protocol. What is it about that the fetish world that created, you know, what from the outside, for someone who's not familiar with them, they might think it was just this kind of like intense, over the top, kind of dangerous, exploitative even kind of place, and yet you found the kind of opposite experience.
Yeah, I've never found the fetish scene or the BDSM scene to be exploitative or scary at all, personally. I've always found it to be very safe, and a lot of the negotiations that happen may seem intense to people from the outside, people who haven't been before or don't understand what's going on, but actually it's really important for people who are negotiating some pretty intense stuff to be in a place where they feel like they are in control of their situation. So there is a lot of structure to the fetish scene and to the BDSM scene, which is totally necessary and creates a totally safe space. I mean, ultimately, as an angsty, kind of rebellious teenager who was into kind of like goth fashion, who I would go out wearing pretty much little else other than my underwear, you know, like lingerie and thigh boots and just basically really, really big hair. And my mom would stop me as I was going out the door and say, "Where are you going? Like, you forgot to put your clothes on." And ultimately, for me, I knew I was going to a safe place. My mom didn't understand because she obviously hadn't experienced anything like that. But a fetish club is actually a really safe place for an angsty teenager wearing their lingerie.
So what did you take from that to King
Crystal? I sometimes go out to bars these days, rarely, but I do occasionally go out to a bar, and I'm absolutely shocked at the way people behave. The kind of sexism that is still rampant in our culture, where, you know, if you walk past, you might get grabbed quite commonly on a Friday or Saturday night in a bar. And that would never happen at a fetish club. Like, if somebody grabbed somebody at a fetish club, they would be absolutely kicked out. And I think that is what creates that safety there. And even though it can feel a little bit uptight sometimes, if you go in and it seems really like there's all these kind of rules that you don't understand until you get into it, and it seems kind of like a little bit geeky and a little bit uptight. I mean, it is all of those things. It is. And they're all necessary to create the space. With Kinky Salon, what's different is that we are not negotiating BDSM. So it's not a BDSM party, even though it's called Kinky Salon. It's not about BDSM. It's about playful exploration of sexuality. And so we don't need those super, super strict rules that are needed to negotiate really heavy BDSM scenes. Hello.
Oh yeah, sorry. There was a cut off for a moment. So it seems that like you're. It's not simply that you're like, oh, let's have a great party. Let's find a great way for people to have fun in this environment. It's like there's a real consciousness you have about kind of tinkering with the social agreements and with the sense of the community that people encounter there. That's about more than sex. It's about how people relate. It's about using that environment as a way to you know, create a novel experience for people, and even a transformative one. But what are some of those like principles or things that you've discovered, or how do you think about that whole quality of almost there's like engineering that's going on kind of behind the scenes? Hello?
Hello, did we lose her?
I think we may have lost her.
Body.
Oh, well, so let us, okay. So one of the things that makes me think of is whether or not the party is erotic is just the power of a great party. And I've thought about that. Like, what is it that can make a great party something that's more than just hanging out, having a good time, you know, whatever, letting off steam, getting drunk, whatever, that there are other ways that parties can be. I mean, when you think about like the best parties you've been to, they're magical, right?
They're pretty magical. I mean, for me, the best parties are ones that don't have that kind of threatening element that Polly was talking about. And I mean, I think that's kind of a big thing is for a lot of people with that expression and letting off steam, there's so much shame and weirdness that they can't let go of, but then there's like always the creep at the party that's gonna like spoil it for everybody. But if you've been to a party where everything is just flowing and everyone feels open to express themselves, I think that's when it starts to get magical.
Well, we have Polly back. I take it, and so yeah, I was just asking you about some of the thoughtfulness that goes into, if you will, engineering or creating rules or creating expectations so that people who are coming to a party situation, you know, are able to lock into a different way of thinking about it, so that you increase the chance that everybody has a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we do at Kinky Salon is we have kind of agreements about behavior that are read out to you as you walk in the door, so that there's no guesswork. That people, so that even newbies, because the problem is, a lot of the time, the people who are overstepping boundaries and doing things outside of what the etiquette is, usually it's just because they're clueless. Normally it's just because they don't know. And so to let people know, so that newbies actually feel comfortable, okay, this is what is okay, and this is what I can do, and this is what I can't do. So, you know, some of our rules are things like you were talking earlier about, you know, the creep at the party who's always, like, you know, kind of pushy. Well, one of our rules is don't cruise aggressively even if they're really cute. So, so that's something that you can get kicked out for, is cruising aggressively. And we have people who are, you know, they're in the party to help with those kinds of situations. So if you feel like someone's cruising aggressively and you need help with the situation, you can find one of our hosts who can come over and have a conversation with the person. And usually that's all it takes. Normally they're just, you know, just clueless. And if you just say, hey, you know, this is aggressive cruising, you're making people feel uncomfortable, you need to stop or you need to leave, then normally it stops. And we also give feedback, too, the next day. There's a lot of emailing of people the next day, like, hey, so you were a bit drunk last night, just letting you know people noticed, kind of thing. And normally just that little nudge, just so the people who we've had conversations with, 99% of the people who we have conversations with thank us. And say, oh, my God, you're so right. I felt so bad the next day, and I'm totally on it. Like, I'm so sorry. And they become our biggest fans. A 1% disappears, and we never see them again. And that's fine.
Another aspect of the thing is humor and the use of, like, the kind of creation of these really you know, a kind of silliness. And this was something that took me a while with Burning Man to kind of understand, is like, you know, from the surface, it just looks like it's just this one person I know went to Burning Man a long time ago, British journalist, and she said she was astounded by the capacity of Americans for infantilism. And I think that's a wrong reading. I think there's something like a serious play that's going on, or even serious silliness, or silliness to a greater purpose because of what it can, the way that it lets fears get down or people to become more kind of tied into almost like an innocent mind. Like you talked about that quality of innocence that you had in growing up around sexuality, that how shocked you were that other people had that. And so it seems like humor is very much one of the things that you've cultivated in kind of an unusual way, I think, as far as those sorts of parties go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think humor and also the concept of dressing up is such a childlike thing to do. The concept of putting on a costume, of getting out the dressing up box and, you know, like throwing on your princess dress. Like it's such a thing from our childhood. And there's something about that, I think, when people get dressed up, when they're in that kind of playful mode, they can kind of somehow release some of that shame that they had when they were children, because they're in that playful mode, and somehow that voice in their head is quietened for long enough for them to explore something. And I think that has a large part to do with it, is the playfulness, the costumes, taking yourself out of your everyday reality into a fantastical world where you're not you and where reality is a little bit different and where the colors are a little brighter and everyone's a little friendlier and more good-looking. You know, and you're just in this kind of wonderful fantasy land that you can explore without all your baggage, you know?
Well, I think there's also, though, an intense kind of flip side to that, is that, I mean, to me, what I know, I mean, you're obviously more of an expert about it, but maybe you've experienced this, too, is when you revert people to their childhood sexuality, I mean, the baggage is there, let's face it, right? Like, 1 in 5 people have been molested, and I think that a lot of our fetishes and sexuality are formulated when we're children. So part of that is that we get to go into the fantasy land in the fetish clubs, but part of those fantasies were formulated in not maybe so healthy ways sometimes. And so, I mean, which I think is positive, because then people get to, like, go back to that and find expression of something which they have been repressing in that way. And so that provides an avenue of expression for something which they really wouldn't find an ability to express anywhere else, like under most circumstances. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have, I mean, you know, at Kinky Salon, people have told me about amazingly transformative experiences that they've had in the play spaces that some people might say, oh, that doesn't sound like a fun Saturday night out. And ultimately, yeah, like sometimes people have really intense experiences when they see things like this. You know, one girl in particular had a memory of being abused when she was in the play space. She was watching somebody and she saw herself and her father, and she just, we had to take her into the back private room and just kind of like sit with her for a while, and she was just having this experience. And so I think that, you know, ultimately, yes, this stuff does come up. Of course, sexuality is one of our deepest places where a lot of our kind of darkest, you know, beasties reside. And so opening this stuff up is not just about having a good time and like getting laid and, you know, dressing up in costumes. It's about personal transformation, and it's about facing dark stuff sometimes too. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, talk a little bit more about that. I mean, that's really why I had you on the show, because, like, on some level, if you just were able to, like, oh, wow, they throw really great sex parties, they're fun and sexy, that's fun, that's great. But what really interests me here is the way that, quite consciously, intentionally on your part, and also in terms of the experiences that people have there, and not just at Kinky Salon, but really, you know, in some ways we're talking about a lot of other, you know, erotically charged, but not even necessarily sexual, cultures of costume and hedonism and play and adult play and whatever word that means, you know, in the Bay Area and every, you know, all over the place. But it's really, what is transformative about it? What are the challenges that people face, and the ways that that particular kind of environment can help people work through things in ways that other sorts of therapies or other approaches don't necessarily do?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I think that approaching these things from a fun and playful angle is obviously the way most things change, right? Is if you're trying to be, you can go into therapy and have a very serious session about things, and you can start to touch on things, talking about them. But if you're engaged in some sort of, you know, super playful, fun, open, and when your heart is open, then you can really start to heal some of this stuff. And I think that negotiating these kinds of environments is not an easy thing to do. And ultimately, you know, it's kind of like Jean Houston of the Human Potential Movement has this thing called social artistry. And I often think about Kinky Salon in those terms. So Jean Houston trains kind of global leaders on how to prepare for the complexity of our culture, which has become so much more complex over the last few decades. And you have to not only take into account what's important for your culture, but for all these different cultures too, like the kind of global culture, and how do you possibly prepare yourself for something like that. And she has this theory called social artistry, which is basically approach your life as if your life were your art form. So approach it with the passion and creativity that you do, that you would if you were a painter approaching a canvas, and where all of the different aspects of your life, like your relationships and the way you interact with people and the things that you do, like approach them as if they were a work of art. And that be approaching it in that context rather than taking things for granted or taking social norms and just, you know, kind of taking them for granted, instead to apply this creativity and artistry to every moment of your life. And I think of Kinky Salon in that way, that people have to be creative, that there's no hard and fast rules about how it works, that every relationship is different. Some people go as single people, some people come in couples, some people come in triads and groups, and it's all very complex how to negotiate this stuff. And I think that that you're really getting to the core of how you can operate in the world and how you can become a better person, how you can reach your potential as a human being through these negotiating these relationships and this environment as if it were your creative passion.
Well, that's wonderful. I want to talk more about this whole, you know, this art, particularly in these collective environments. You know, and I was also thinking about Burning Man when you were describing that situation. But we got to take a break now. So you're listening to Expanding Mind. This is Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking to Polly Superstar, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
Tune in to Cities Grace Notes, where we'll be bringing you inspired voices from around the world, creative voices from various fields and backgrounds, new sounds, new music, and new ideas with your host, CD. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Maj Gaou here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Polly Superstar, such a great handle, who works with Kinky Salon, and we're talking about sex. And before the break, we were talking about just that integration that Kinky Salon provides and that transformational aspect. And Polly, I am very interested in the kind of amalgamation of sexuality and spirituality, because as soon as you start entering, you know, the kind of spiritual and metaphysical community, you, all of those things get up where people either like just go for it, but usually everyone separates sexuality from everything else they're doing, right? Like whether it's their spiritual pursuits or their job or whatever, like sexuality gets stuck in this little kind of corner where like that's okay, that's where it's okay to do that. But In what you provide with the Kinky Salon is really like a lot more than just a corner where sexuality happens, right? It's a community and it's part of the culture. I mean, for some people, it's a big like kind of spin-off where their culture forms. Like I know in the goth community, a lot of those fetish clubs are literally like the hub of the center of their community and culture. And I mean, that is pretty huge that sexual expression would be the hub of a cultural exchange. To me, is like totally innovative, because you look at most communities and it's literally, like I said, stuck in that corner. So I'm just curious, how do you see people's lives transformed through that kind of inclusion of sexuality? Can you think of like maybe one striking example where, I know we talked about how you've talked to people that like some of their dark issues are brought up and intensified, but have you like witnessed individuals who have told you that like literally their lives have been changed or altered through this kind of exchange?
Oh, absolutely. We've had people quit their jobs after coming to Kinky Salon, people who have, you know, had their lives completely transformed, you know, much in the same way that people do, you know, the first time they go to Burning Man, where they're just so blown open by the fact that this kind of reality even exists, that they, after experiencing it, they can't go back to the default reality, that they have to play their part. People who have quit their jobs to become, you know, polyamory relationship coaches, or, you know, stuff to support this culture. So yeah, many, many people in the community have completely had these transformative experiences. And there are still people who, you know, still live kind of double lives. And I think that it's important to respect that too, as being, you know, as being something that's positive in a way, because they are bringing culture across the barriers too, you know. But that was one of the reasons too why we had to create Openly, which is the social network that we've created that's kind of for open-minded, sex-positive community. And there was when Facebook first started, and they had that absolute train wreck of privacy that continues to be a train wreck, where people have stuff posted non-consensually come up on their news feed about like the party they went to last night or something, and it's just impossible for people to get any sense of privacy in Facebook. And so we created Openly in order to create a space where people could be themselves and not have fear that their boss or their little sister was going to see that they went to Kinky Salon last night.
Oh, man. Well, it's true, and I think that, like, that's people's fear, right, is, like you said, which leads to double lives and stuff. It's like, well, okay, so I know that I'm into this and I really like this fetish, but then am I really ready to just, like, have that be the topic of conversation with my family and, like, everyone in the community who is not that openly expressive? I mean, every, like, homosexual kind of goes through that, I think, when they come out of the closet, you know.
Absolutely.
And then they have to deal with that. And so I think, like, people that do are open with their sexuality kind of have to go through that same kind of thing with the community. So it's much better if they get to do it by choice than have it happen on Facebook, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And that does happen. I mean, people who are in this kind of sex-positive community have just as many issues with their parents as gay people do. And even though it's, you know, some people might say, well, you know, you're making a lifestyle choice. You know, being gay isn't a lifestyle choice.
Yeah, right.
But I don't feel like being polyamorous or enjoying, you know, expressing yourself in a sexual way, like maybe in front of other people, I don't see it as a choice. I see it as just like a natural expression of myself. So I see it as being the same thing. And I know certainly a lot of people who have difficulty with their parents, who, you know, keep secret lives, and with their jobs too, people who would be absolutely mortified if people knew, and who might even get fired. I mean, I also know of people who have been fired for having blogs, sexually explicit blogs, people who have literally been fired from their jobs for expressing themselves sexually. And I think that that's just evidence of our culture's continued repression of sexuality. And I think that people are scared of it, you know, because it is so deep and it is so rooted in our power, you know, that people are terrified that if they express themselves, if they're given the space to, that, you know, that I don't know, the world will fall apart or something.
One of the really, you know, significant dimensions there is, and you mentioned polyamory, is that whether or not people decide that that's the kind of thing for them, it seems like it's a really important thing for people to kind of confront that possibility, because it raises so many fears, so much programming. I mean, in a way, that's one of the strongest kind of. That's even more shocking, I think, to a lot of people than you know, homosexuality at this point. I mean, it's like totally, you know, like acceptable in a lot of parts of our society, even people who aren't gay or don't even know any gay people. It's like, okay, yeah, some people are gay, but, you know, they're couples, right? Like, it's almost more challenging to think that one could be satisfied and loving
with
more than one partner.
And I think what's interesting, too, is how many different levels of relationships there are. Once you start to open your eyes and see the possibility within relationships, it's not just that there's monogamy and polyamory, but there's all kinds of experiences between the two, like extreme monogamy, for example, where you believe that all your emotional needs can be met by one person, and where you, if your partner is even talking to another person, that kind of upsets you. Like, why were you talking to her? Like, you get people staring at their husbands across the room, you know. and like, for a lot of people, that's kind of absurd. It's kind of absurd to a lot of, like, liberal, normal, you know, married couples. Like, oh, well, we would never be like that. Of course we allow our partners to have same-sex friendships and go out for dinner with people of the same sex, and we don't freak out. Well, I feel the same way about my partner having a sexual relationship with somebody. To me, I'm like, well, of course, that just seems totally natural and normal to me. So I think it's about finding where you are in that scale. It could even be that maybe you just want to explore something with another person. So add another person into your relationship so that you become a triad, and that feels safe and good to you. But you would never allow your partner to go on a date on their own.
Right.
Well, can I just ask you, do you find that works for you? I mean, do you have repercussions? I mean, we're all people, so I know even if you're liberal, do you find that there isn't hurt feelings and issues that come up between you and your partner?
That's actually one of the biggest misconceptions about polyamory that I've heard is that you don't get jealous. Of course you get jealous. Of course it gets hard, and you argue, and you say, and things hurt. But the point isn't that life is easy. The point is that you explore, like, why does that feel bad? I know you love me. I know that our relationship is solid. Why does what you just did make me feel bad? Wow, it makes you look at yourself in a new way. It makes you look deeply at the issues that you're holding on to. You can't hide when you're in a polyamorous relationship. You can't hide from your issues, you know. You have to face them because they come up. And that's, again, going back to the social artistry thing, this is one of the most important things for me about polyamory, is being able to, being given the opportunity to face stuff that you wouldn't face otherwise, where you're like, wow, that feels bad, maybe because of stuff from my childhood, like maybe this is to do with my dad, or like whatever issues you have, that you can come up, that you can start talking about this stuff, and then you can start being sensitive to each other in particular ways. Well, I know that you've got that thing, and I know it's really unreasonable, but I'm gonna be gentle with you in that area because I know that that's difficult for you. For example, you know, one person might be fine with the other person staying out all night and not hearing from them until the next day, and that's absolutely fine for them. They don't feel weird. But the other one maybe had something happen when they were a kid where their parents both went out and never came back, and you know, and didn't call, and it gave them a panic that is still in them. And so really all they need is the phone call at midnight saying goodnight, and then they're fine. And that's, I think learning this stuff about each other and learning to be gentle with each other and learning where to say, you know what, actually, I can't do that for you, or yes, I can do that for you, and like meeting somewhere in the middle in your negotiation helps you learn about yourself, about your partner, helps you to be more compassionate, and helps you to really deepen your relationship.
I think it's also, there's also a social dimension to it, and it's very, very challenging. And observing people go through this, it's like if there's any part of our society where we, you know, sort of all agree to kind of lie or push difficult emotions under a sort of narrative, it's in the kind of stories of monogamy and the way that monogamy breaks down, and then there's a lover, and then there's confession, and then there's requite, and there's this kind of narrative that you see repeated over and over in cinema and books and people's lives. And one of the things that's really interesting, you know, sociologically, philosophically about polyamory is the way it goes, it doesn't have to be that way. And the way in which people just generically assume that it does have to be that way. And in opening up to that and seeing that, that it is a narrative, that it is a, you know, a program we've accepted on some level, you start to see a deeper way in which society, you know, controls us or maps us or organizes our experience. And it's a very shocking one, and it's very shocking to other people too. I think, you know, some people find all the things, would find the kinds of things you're talking about, even though you're being so reasonable and so generous and smart about it, that nonetheless it's just so shocking that you almost don't want to wrap your head around it. The idea that you'd have a lover or that you'd cheat is totally understandable, or that you'd be dating and have multiple partners. But once you're in a loving, you know, long-term partner structure, then all bets are off, and you've got to follow this sort of map.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's an issue that spreads out further than just how we are in relationship. And actually, I think it's more of a general cultural kind of suppression of the goddess archetype, which brings about scarcity. People feel scarcity. The feeling of scarcity is what drives our economy. The feeling of scarcity is what creates the wars that we have. People are scared. They're scared that if they don't hold on for dear life to what they have, then they'll be the one who's ultimately outside in the cold, because there's not enough to go around, and there isn't enough. And I think that people apply that to love as well as to stuff, and that there's this concept that, you know, if you don't hold on to that man, then you're going to be alone. And people have so much fear around losing love, when ultimately, you know, love isn't scarce. Love is abundant. Love isn't a person. Love is a feeling. So I think that people get stuck in that scarcity myth. And I think that when scarcity is applied to our emotions, it's even more scary than it is when it's applied to our stuff. It's going into the deep core of our fears, of our unconscious fears, you know?
I think that's a really good point, and I think possession on all levels, like, ties into that. And I thought about it a lot and done a lot of research on, like, animal behavior with that, too, because then, like, I always like to look at nature and see what happens there. And you can look at, like, birds, which are, like, the most monogamous of all species. But then even they will have, like, adulterous affairs but then come back to their mate. So, like, if you look even at monogamy in the animal kingdom, there are some exceptions where, you know, the animals are monogamous forever, like with some seahorses and stuff like that. But then the majority do follow this pattern, like what Eric was talking about, how people will do it anyway, but they'll just, like, cheat, and then, you know, they won't be open about it. But even in the animal kingdom, there's possession, and I think that idea of scarcity plays into that, is that once you find that mate, right, that it's like this competition, and I think competition is also the other thing, right? You want to be that alpha expression, and if your partner is with someone else, and that means you're not the top dog, right? Like, it becomes about dominance too. So you have, like, scarcity, fear, dominance, and possession all kind of feeding into that idea, which we see, I think, just inherently kind of expressed in the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a really interesting book called Sex at Dawn, which kind of really goes into looking at our roots, our sexual history. And there's some assumptions that were made, you know, around the time of Darwin about our genetic kind of push as human beings.
Right.
Like,
right.
How it is that we are in relationship. And it was really influenced by Darwin, and also really influenced by Victorian culture, where the assumption was made, and this is what's still taught in schools today, the assumption is that men want to have their seed land in a female. Like, that's basically their goal of life. It doesn't really matter who it is, they just want to procreate with as many women as possible.
Right.
Whereas women have this kind of desire to find the strongest, most powerful man. and the man who can take care of her, and so, and her and the baby, you know. So they'll always go. That's why women go after wealthy, you know, tall, strapping men, because they're like, yes, that man can take care of me, you know. And there are all these assumptions around, you know, men. The reason that men, you know, need monogamy is because they need to know that the child that their wife is carrying belongs to them, because they have this Darwinist instinct to continue their line.
Well, that's so interesting that you bring that up, because in the bird studies, what they found was it was the lady birds that were cheating on the men, because the offspring did not always belong to the father. So they found, like, you know, it's right. So funny that that's what's perpetuated, because it's not even true in nature.
Right, right. And ultimately what they're discovering, looking back historically at kind of Stone Age man and kind of hunter-gatherer kind of tribes, is that actually this kind of Darwinist theory of, like, you know, I have my genes that I want to pass on selfishly to continue my line was actually not, it actually wasn't how people were operating back in the Stone Age. And actually, right. Actually people lived in these kind of weird amorphous polyamorous groups where the goal was everybody was raising everybody else's children, and that the children were actually quite, you know, there was no definition as to whose children they were. They belonged to the whole tribe, and that the tribe was actually very, you know, everybody shared everybody, and that they're discovering that this is actually humanity's history, and actually that all of the assumptions that we've made about our kind of like genetic striving for our personal genes to be passed on are actually it's actually assumptions that people have made because of our culture.
Well, that's where you really get into one of the secret tricks of what patriarchy is that patriarchy is a system to authenticate from the male perspective, lineage and descent. Since there's always some ambiguity in a world before there's DNA testing about who actually fathered this child, patriarchy exists, and not just patriarchy as a social system, but as a religious system. That's, you know, so all of the prohibitions, the ideas about monotheism that are bound up with Christianity, it's not that Christianity is evil. There's a lot of good things about Christianity, but it's in the sense that it was and is, to some degree, a patriarchal system. It's partly to just do something very basic with how people are reproduced and how people are brought into an idea of lineage because of the purposes that it serves, you know, kings and rulers and people who own things. So it gets really, really deep, this connection. It works on so many different levels.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what else are you up to? We got about 5 minutes left here. Oh, actually, I want to hear a little bit about Peep Show Mini Golf. I think people should know a little bit about Peep Show Mini Golf.
Oh, Peep Show Mini Golf is two of America's favorite pastimes joined together for the first time in human history, the miniature golf course and the girly Peep Show. And it's kind of a ridiculous affair. We have this portable miniature golf hole that we built that we take around unexpected places, and we play mini golf with the general public. Peep Show Mini Golf isn't something that we do on our own in our little private artist enclaves. We go out into the world and invite people to putt, and hopefully give them an experience that shakes them out of their everyday reality for a moment, and then sends them back again.
Yeah, I was happy to say that we got to include Peep Show Mini Golf in the first version of How to Survive the Apocalypse, the Burning Man rock opera that I was involved with, and it was a merry time was had by all.
I don't think you can fail to have a good time when there are those two things involved. You know, it's just basically a recipe for good times.
So what else are you up to? Tell me what's going on with Kinky Salon. What's going on? What are you working on now?
Well, Kinky Salon is, like I said at the beginning of the show, we've taken the formula of Kinky Salon and shared it with some event producers across the world. We have Kinky Salon happening in London. Very recently, we have Kinky Salon Copenhagen and Kinky Salon Amsterdam. So Europe is really going for it. Apparently, they love it over there. And so that's been really fun. I went over to London in December to experience my first Kinky Salon London, and it was quite amazing that it actually worked. the formula works. I went over there and I was like, wow, this is totally like Kinky Salon. It's like a little bit geeky, you know, it's like totally ridiculously costumed, sexy, weird, cool people just having a good time. And I was like, this feels like a Kinky Salon.
You know, I wanted to talk a little bit, even though we have a few minutes, just a little bit more about costume, because as people might gather from the show is that Polly has an extraordinary wardrobe and is extremely vital and entertaining and sexy and beautiful and goofy in her manner of expression. But I wanted it to once again to like emphasize the depth of the surface is just how transformative that kind of thing can be. And I after moving to San Francisco, you know, ran into a friend of mine a few years ago, and I was talking about, you know, how people change or not change over the years. You know, it's a constant theme. You know, do people actually change? And he said to me, he goes, you know, you actually changed at one point. You know, when I first met you, when you were first in San Francisco, you were always kind of nerdy and you kind of like, you were kind of held back. You were anxious in social situations. And then you kind of like broke out and you started to dress different or whatever. And I realized that partly by going to Burning Man, around 2000, 2001, I got into costuming and I just decided to like enjoy it. And even though I'm not on the Olympian stage of a poly superstar, that this seemingly superficial thing of becoming playful and engaged and creative with dress, at least just some of the time, was actually very personally transformed in terms of how I expressed my confidence and sort of engagement with people in social situations. So even the mere costume can be a transformative thing.
Absolutely, I agree. And, you know, one of the things that I always say to people about Kinky Salon, too, is that it's not about, like, having some custom-made fabulous costume made for hundreds of dollars. Like, a lot of my stuff is just, you know, stuff that I've bought at thrift stores or literally those Halloween costumes that you get in a bag, you know? And it just kind of dressed it up one way or another. And I think the most important thing is to just do what's fun and just express yourself and be authentic to yourself rather than worrying about how you look. I remember once when I was a teenager, a friend of mine just put a trash bag over his head with a belt around it, you know? And like that was the ultimate goth look.
Great. Well, just to rattle off a couple of URLs, missioncontrolsf.org, kinkysalon.com, and of course, Peep Show Mini Golf and openly.us. Hey, Polly, thanks so much for being with us here at Expanding Mind. I hope that you become a radio host yourself. You have a great voice and you're very articulate about the stuff you do. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Eric. It was fun.
Okay, so from me and Maja here at Expanding Mind, keep your minds open.